All right, so this is Bio 160, and it is October 23rd. Please don't forget the test next Tuesday on the 28th. Tuesday, the 28th. And that's going to be on muscle, nerve, and senses. And we're going to finish up senses today. Okay, and don't forget the lecture notes that are online have the figures that you can practice labeling. So if you practice labeling those, I would guess 10 times, you're going to get 100% on that part of the test. As a matter of fact, maybe you only have to label it 5 times. Right? And if you have trouble remembering how to label and you're not making any progress after you've done it 8 times and it doesn't look like you're getting any better at it, then you actually might want to draw the figures just on a blank piece of paper and then label it to help get it soak into your mind. Okay? So you can try that. All right, so any questions? Somebody had a question? Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I tell you what, if you want to go up to my office, also we can review all your grades, if you want to look at tests or get your Scantrons back or any of that kind of stuff. Absolutely, we can do that. I just didn't bring all that stuff down with me today. Okay? All right, so let's see what we can do with senses. We were sort of done with the eye, I believe. Okay. And moving on to the ear. And we were looking at a couple of these figures. Oh yeah, I like this figure a lot. This is probably an exam figure. This one right here. All right, so the ear should be divided into 3 general locations. All right, 3 anatomical divisions. And the first one is the outer ear. The outer ear starts with the auricle. Sometimes we call that the pinna of the ear. And maybe even talked about the tragus and antitragus. Did we talk about that last? No, we didn't. That was another class. Never mind. Okay, the tragus is that cartilage. I did mention it in the other class. All right, the tragus is this flap that's kind of sticking out, protecting your external auditory meatus. And then there's another piece of cartilage that's attached to your earlobe. And that's used clinically a lot. Sometimes we put traction on the antitragus like this. And if that produces pain, that's a sign for something. That's a sign that there is an infection in the middle ear. And what kind of people have a tendency to get an infection of this middle ear right here? Like babies, right? So it's really hard to diagnose sometimes, because they can't talk to you to tell you what's wrong. But if you pull on their ear and they start crying, well, then you know, like doctors have a tendency to do sometimes, right? Like if you have a broken bone, what do? They bend it and they go, does this hurt? Does that hurt? And you go, well, of course that hurts. All right, so putting traction on the tragus sometimes is a nice indication of an infection here of the middle ear compartment. So the line of demarcation between the external ear and the middle ear is this tympanic membrane. The tympanic membrane is very thin, and when sound goes in the external auditory meatus, it will vibrate back and forth. And when it vibrates back and forth on the medial side of the tympanic membrane, there is a bone. And that bone is called the malleus, and that bone is connected to the incus, and then the incus is connected to the stapes. So these 3 auditory ossicles transmit sound vibrations, which are in the air, into the third part of the ear, which is the inner ear. So we see the inner ear over here, the middle right here, and the external in this direction. So here are the auditory ossicles. They're really, really small. I could put all 3 of them between my fingertips and you couldn't see them because they're so small. But nonetheless, they are distinct individual bones. And their job is to transmit sound energy from the outside world to the inner ear. And the inner ear is filled with fluid. So if we look at the inner ear, you see something that looks like a snail. We call that the cochlea. That's filled with fluid. And then this part right here is what we call the vestibule. That's filled with fluid. And then you see things that kind of look like circles right here. We call those the semicircular canals. They're filled with the same kind of fluid. So it's difficult for sound energy to enter the fluid of the fluid compartment of the inner ear. And that's what the job of the auditory ossicles is to enhance or amplify the transmission of sound energy into that fluid. And you probably might be aware of that. So for instance, if you're ever in a swimming pool or something, and you had a friend sitting out on a chair or something on the deck of the swimming pool, if your head's above water, you can carry on a conversation. But if you were to go underneath the water, the surface of the water, would you be able to hear your friend that's sitting by the pool deck or on the pool deck? And that's because sound energy really doesn't like to go into the water. So that's the job of these bones right here, is to force that sound underwater into the fluid component of the inner ear. And I think last time we talked about this auditory tube, right? And that's just a way to equalize pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane right here, because if pressure builds up on one side or the other, it's going to push the tympanic membrane all the way to one side, and then it can't vibrate back and forth. And if it can't vibrate back and forth, then you can't hear anything. So the same thing, for instance, if the middle ear fills up with fluid or maybe even pus or something, if there's an infection, then the tympanic membrane can't vibrate either, and somebody's going to lose a certain amount of hearing in that particular ear because the tympanic membrane isn't vibrating at all. Okay, so these are the auditory ossicles. And let's look at, in particular now, the inner ear, which contains the snail-shaped structure. This is what we call the vestibular apparatus. All right, so all of this stuff right here is the vestibular apparatus, and it's got a couple parts to it. The thing that looks like a snail is what we call the cochlea. The cochlea is important for the sense of hearing. This is responsible for hearing. The vestibule, which is this region right here, is important for static equilibrium, and I'll tell you what static equilibrium is in just a little bit. And then these canals are important for the third special sense in the ear, and we call that kinetic equilibrium. So semicircular canals, kinetic equilibrium, vestibule, static equilibrium, and the cochlea is for hearing. All right, on the vestibular apparatus, there are two holes which are covered by membranes, because the membranes keep the fluid inside the vestibular apparatus. The one that's connected to the stapes is called the oval window, and the other hole that's down closer to the auditory tube, that's called the round window. So oval window and round window. And you probably should never get them mixed up, because what is the footprint of the stapes right here? Does it look round to you? Or does it look oval? It looks more oval, right? Like a regular stirrup that you would put your foot into when you're riding a horse. So that doesn't look round at all. So that can't cover the round window. That covers the oval window. Okay. All right, so let's look in a little bit more detail of that vestibular apparatus. Here it is. All right, so this part right here is the cochlea. That gives you the sense or the perception of sound, right? So that's important for hearing. The vestibule is this region right here. That's for static equilibrium. And the semicircular canals are important for kinetic or dynamic equilibrium. Kinetic or dynamics can go by either one of those two designations. All right, so the cochlea is actually a bony kind of material. It's very hard. The same thing for the vestibule. On the outside, it's hard, and the semicircular canals have a nice tough calcium coat over them. So we call that the bony labyrinth of the inner ear. So you got three bony labyrinths, the cochlea, the vestibule, and the semicircular canals. And in the vestibule, you have the oval window. What's connecting up to the oval window right here? The stapes. Right, and then you have this round window with nothing connected up to it. That just opens up to the middle ear, which is just sort of that atmospheric pressure. Now, the reason why you have that is because when the stapes vibrates, it introduces pressure to the cochlea, and that pressure goes into the cochlea and then comes back out through a different tube. And if that pressure were to stay inside the ear, that would actually would break the cochlea, would cause it to fracture. And so the round window right here just allows that sound energy that was put into it from the stapes at the oval window to exit into the middle ear so that the cochlea doesn't break. You don't want to break that cochlea. Okay, so let's look at the organ for hearing. The organ for hearing is right here. All right, so the cochlea is actually a very long organ, but it's coiled up. Why is it all coiled up like that? Yeah, so that it can fit in the temporal bone. All right, so if it was really long, it would be sticking way inside your brain, and there's no space for it there. So it's all wound up, so we can stick it just inside the temporal, inside the middle ear. Okay, and there are a number of different canals. Right, so we can unroll the cochlea. And if we unroll it and look just at a cross-section of it, right, we can see that it's got a couple chambers that are filled with fluid. It's got three fluid-filled chambers. And sound comes in, the scale of vestibuli right here, and then it's going to find its way into the scala tympani. And then from the scala tympani, it's going to find its way to the round window and escape the cochlea. So it's got to go through this structure right here. Sound actually has to move through this structure. And when it moves through this structure, guess what happens to the structure when sound vibrations move through it? It vibrates because sound produces vibrations. Right, and this structure right here in the middle of the cochlea is what we call the organ of Corti. And so let's zoom into this organ of Corti. What does it look like? It's got a membrane that is sitting on atop of number of cells over here that have these projections like cilia poking up into this membrane. We call this the tectorial membrane. This is the membrane that vibrates when sound enters your ear. And when it vibrates, it presses on these cilia, which then causes electrical signals, right? And the electrical signals then are passed on to the brain via the cochlear nerve. So you can see a number of these cells that have these cilia. And when somebody first looked at these cells, they called them hair cells because these cilia just look like little hairs poking up off the top of them. So when these little hairs bend, that starts an electrical signal that goes to the brain. So what do I want you to know about this? I want you to know what organ this is. What organ is this? This is the organ of Corti. And what's the sense that you derive from this organ? That's hearing. And what is the receptor cell that allows you to hear something? It's these hair cells. So that's kind of strange. Right? You never would have guessed that there are hair cells inside your ear that allow you to hear something. Okay, and these are all inside the cochlea, which is this thing right here. So here's the cochlea. Now you might be wondering, how is it that you can hear different frequencies? Well, let's take a look at this cochlea. So we're going to, first we have what, the cochlea all wound up like that. But what could we do? We could unroll it. All right, so let's unroll it. I just unrolled it all the way out so it's nice and flat. Now it's nice and long. All right, if we look, this is what it looks like from the side. It's just flat, but let's look down from the top and take a look and see what it looks like from the top. Okay, from the top, starting here, it kind of looks like this. So if we look in the dimension in and out of the board, right, and then look down from the top, this is how wide the cochlea is. This is the width of the cochlea, if you look down from the top. Where is the cochlea the widest? Is it close to the oval and round window, or is it really close to, for instance, the widest out over by the tip, all right? And the tip is called the helicotrema. I don't think you have to know that in this class, but so we'll just call it the tip, all right? So it's the widest at the tip over here. And so when I look at something like that, and don't forget it's got that organ of Corti going through the middle of it like this. It's got the organ of Corti. That sort of reminds me of a musical instrument. What kind of musical instrument has really small things in it on one end, like medium-sized things in the middle, and then really big, long things on the other end of it? Like if you ever looked at an organ with organ pipes, you can see that an organ has all different sized organ pipes. Or if you look at a piano, on the inside of a piano, okay, what do you see? You see the strings, all the strings inside the piano, okay, they're really, really thin, short ones on one side, and then there's really, really long, thick ones on the other. And that corresponds to the tone that they produce. All right, so if we have a really, really thin string right here and a really, really long, thick one right here, what's the frequency that these things like to vibrate at? Does anybody have a feel for that? These short ones here are going to make the really high pitches, the high frequency ones, ones I can't even reproduce, so I won't try, right? But these really long, thick ones are going to reproduce the bass frequencies, the very low frequencies. And then, of course, the ones in the middle are going to be what we call mid-range, right? So when you hit this key on a piano, you hear a mid-tone, like middle C, for instance. And then if you hit over here, of course, a piano, I guess, is backwards compared to this diagram. All right, then you're going to hear a low frequency because it's going to vibrate at a lower frequency, but this one will vibrate at a very high frequency, producing a very high pitch. Well, the ear works the same way. When the frequency of sound comes in, depending on what the frequency is, if it's a mid-tone, it's going to go through the organ of Corti right at this location and then just stimulate these hair cells in this location right here. But if it's a really low frequency, the sound is going to do what? Go all the way to the end of the organ of Corti, or to the end of the cochlea, and when it goes across, it's going to vibrate these hair cells over here. So different hair cells are going to be stimulated depending on the frequency of the sound energy that enters your ear. And if you have three frequencies that enter the ear, well, there might be one region here that gets stimulated, and one region over here gets stimulated, and another over here that gets stimulated, and you hear three tones, and if those three tones are in a proper proportion to each other, what do we call that when you hear three notes together? That's what we call a, for instance, a chord in music. So your ear can hear separate frequencies, or it can hear a combination of frequencies. All right, and then of course, this is going to send a signal to the brain, and these are going to send a signal to the brain, and you have a region in the brain that can appreciate these three different tones that will give you that sense of music. Okay, so what kind of hair cells, what kind of cells are here in the organ of Corti? Yeah, they're hair cells, sorry about that. All right, those are hair cells right here that send electrical information to the brain. Hair cells. All right, and so this structure that we unrolled, what did we call this structure right here with the bony labyrinth? That's the cochlea, and this organ that contains the hair cells, this is what we call the organ of Corti. So for hearing, I want you to know what the bony labyrinth is. That's the cochlea. The organ for hearing is the organ of Corti, and the receptor cells are hair cells. And they're just arranged in this fashion. So actually, what do you have on either side of your head inside that temporal bone? You actually have like two pianos, one in one ear, one in the other, that allow you to perceive sound. That's pretty much exactly how it works. Okay, so that's for hearing. The next thing, let's talk about static equilibrium first. Static equilibrium gives you the sense of head position. So even with your eyes closed, you can tell if your head is upright or if your head is lying down or pointed forward. So, and that's because gravity is always pulling on your head and pulling on the structures inside your inner ear. The structures where you have the sense of static equilibrium are in the vestibule, this part of the ear. Remember, this part right here is for hearing. This middle part is for static equilibrium. And there are two places, the utricle and the saccule. Both of these contain a structure that's called a maculae. The utricle and saccule contain the maculae. And this is how the maculae work. One of them is macula. All right, so we're talking about these two areas right here within the vestibular apparatus. So there's a little bulge, and there is a gelatinous mass, kind of like a little piece of jelly, and sticking up into that jelly are some cilia from, look at these cells right here. What are those cells called? They're called hair cells again, okay? Because they stick these little like hair processes up into this gelatin, and the gelatin flows around a little bit. It's like Jell-O. If you were to take a bowl of Jell-O and stick it on its side, the Jell-O would kind of, what, sag with gravity a little bit. So the same thing for this Jell-O right here. But it sags a little bit more than usual because sitting on top of it are these little grains of calcium carbonate. So these are like little crystals or little rocks sitting on top of this gelatinous mass. And so when your head is straight, these are pushing, what, straight down on the hair cells. And it really doesn't bend the hair cells very much. But as soon as you bend your head forward, okay, so what happens to this macula here? It changes position. It goes to this position. And so now these little crystals, which we call otoliths, they pull down on the gelatinous mass. They get it to sag a little bit, and then that pulls on these cilia, these little processes, and then that sets up electrical signals in these cells that go to your brain that give you the sense of head position. Even though you're not moving, you get a sense of what position your head is in. If it's straight up or bent forward, if you're lying down in a bed or something, you have this sense of head position because gravity is pulling straight down like that. So you got some of these little crystals inside your inner ear that deform these hair cells. All right, so what is the bony labyrinth for? Well, I tell you what, first, what is this sense that we're talking about right here? Is it hearing? It is a kind of equilibrium. What kind of equilibrium? Static equilibrium, right? So this is static equilibrium. All right, so that's a sense. And what is the bony labyrinth that we have these organs in? The bony labyrinth is the vestibule. And these organs right here are called, one is called a macula, and you have two of them. One is in the utricle and the other is in the saccule. So I'm going to review this when we're done talking about these different senses. Okay. All right, the last, what's the last sense of the inner ear? Okay, it's an equilibrium sense. All right, so we talked about hearing. We're talking about balance. We're done with static equilibrium. What we're going to talk about next is kinetic equilibrium. And again, it involves the inner ear. Kinetic equilibrium has to do with your sense of spinning, which we call rotational acceleration. They don't really respond when you move in a linear fashion, like straight in front of you or straight behind you or up and down, okay? But it's a more of a rotational sense. And you might have messed around with your semicircular canals when you were a little kid. For instance, maybe you spun around real fast and then stopped. And what happened to the world when you stopped all of a sudden? It kept spinning. Okay? So I'll show you what was going on inside your ear. There's a part of your inner ear that actually keeps spinning for a little while even though you stopped. Right? So if you start spinning and stop, there's still a part of your inner ear that spins for a little while that actually gives you the sense that the world is spinning, even though you know you're not spinning and the world isn't. But there's still some part of your ear that is. So kinetic equilibrium comes from these three semicircular canals. And they're continuous. Okay, so they're continuous. And there's a fluid inside these semicircular canals that can flow in what? A circle. That fluid can flow in a circle, and can flow in a circle here, and flow in a circle here. All right, and you see that you have three semicircular canals because how many dimensions are there in space? Are there different ways? How many different ways can you go? Basically, three different ways, right? You can go anterior, posterior, that's one. You can go right and left. And what's another way? Up and down, right? So there are three dimensions to space. And you can spin in any one of those three dimensions, and it's these semicircular canals that will tell your body which way you're actually spinning, right? But for instance, if you're not spinning straight anterior, posterior, or right and left, you could spin at some kind of angle. That means what? Then two of these semicircular canals are going to be responding, and your brain will figure out what angle you're spinning at as well. Okay, so the semicircular canals are important for kinetic or dynamic equilibrium. The organ inside a semicircular canal, so here's one semicircular canal, the organ that gives you the sense of kinetic equilibrium is what we call the crista ampullaris. And that's kind of similar to a macula in that you have a gelatinous mass right here, but this one we call the cupula. Right, we don't necessarily call it a gelatinous mass, but this is a cupula, and you see that's within a semicircular canal, and surrounding it over in this region right here is the fluid in that semicircular canal. All right, so when you're standing upright, these hairs from... Look at these cells right here. What are these cells again called? Hair cells. All right. These hairs, or the cilia from these hair cells, don't get bent because the cupula is just pushing straight down. Right? And these hair cells are connected to nerve fibers, which then will go to the brain. So when you're not spinning, these cells are at rest. They're not sending any signals. But when you start spinning, right, these hair cells are attached to your body or your head. So when you start spinning, is your head spinning? When you start spinning, does your head spin? Yeah, absolutely, because it's attached to your body, right? So your head spins. But what about this fluid inside the semicircular canal? It's not attached to anything. Okay, what you could do maybe at home is take a glass of water. Oh, you probably experienced this. Like you have a glass with something in it. You know, like some water, Kool-Aid, or something, right? And all of a sudden, a bug gets in it, right? And a bug gets on the far side, and you want to get the bug out. So you turn the glass so that you can take your finger and get the bug out. But when you turn the glass, where does the bug stay? It stays right where it was. Because you're turning the glass, but the fluid inside the glass doesn't turn. Unless you turn the glass for a long period of time, then the fluid catches up to the turning of the glass, right? And then, for instance, right, so now the bug is by you, and then you stop the glass from turning, what happens to the bug? It keeps turning, right, because the fluid has accumulated that, what we call inertia. Another way of talking about this is that if something is in motion, it has a tendency to stay in that motion, okay, unless another force acts on it. Or if something is stationary, it has a tendency to stay stationary unless there is a force applied to it. So, what holiday is coming up real soon? Yeah, Christmas, Thanksgiving, okay? I would like you to perform this experiment, Thanksgiving time, okay? So, everybody's going to have, like, a table filled with stuff, right? Water glasses and sweet potatoes and wine glasses filled with wine and all that kind of stuff. And what could you do? And there's a nice tablecloth on top of the table. What could you do to prove the point that objects that are stationary have a tendency to stay put? All right, what could you do? You could, all right, let me see, make sure I do this okay. You could pull the tablecloth out from underneath all of those wine glasses and everything without spilling anything, right? So put that on YouTube. So what could you do? What do you have to do? Just pull it really fast like that. Okay, so these objects didn't really want to move. They wanted to stay stationary. Okay, I guess I'll give that back to you. Yeah, my teacher made me do it. Okay. So, getting back to the crista ampullaris right here. All right, so when you start spinning, the crista ampullaris, since it's attached to your body, is going to start to spin. But what about that fluid? The fluid is going to be like this stapler in the drink we had here. It's going to want to stay stationary. So, the fluid is staying stationary, but the crista ampullaris is moving, so that's like having the fluid flowing over the crista ampullaris, in particular the cupula right here. And when that fluid presses up against the cupula, guess what happens? Okay, it's going to deform it, and it's going to bend these hair cells. So for instance, when somebody starts spinning, the fluid is going to bend the cupula, it's going to bend those hair cells, and that's going to send electrical signals to the brain saying that your head is spinning. And then, say you're spinning for a long period of time, and then you stop, what happens there? Well, that fluid now has caught up to your motion, and you stop, so your head is stopped, right? And you stop that crista ampullaris, but the fluid is still in motion, so what is it going to do? It's going to push the cupula in the opposite direction until the flow stops, and that's going to give you that sense that the world is spinning around you. Okay, and so you have three of these for taking into account all three dimensions that you could possibly be spinning at. Right, and that's this sense of kinetic equilibrium or spinning. All right, so let's put a little synopsis on the board of what we talked about in terms of the ear. Okay. All right, so let me ask you first, what are the parts of the ear, the three main parts of the ear? External, the middle, and inner. All right, so of those parts, which ones do you need for hearing? Which ones do you need for static equilibrium, and which ones do you need for kinetic equilibrium? So where's that picture of the ear at? Who's got it? Right here. Here's that picture of the ear. So you got the outer, you've got the middle, and you got the inner. All right? So what part of the inner ear is necessary for hearing? Is there a part in the inner ear necessary for hearing? The cochlea. All right? So you need the inner ear for hearing. What about the middle ear? You need the middle ear? Could we like pour glue in there or cement or something? Could you hear? Everybody's shaking your head no. And why is that? Because these auditory ossicles have to vibrate back and forth, right? The tympanic membrane has to vibrate back and forth. So in order for you to hear, you need the middle ear. What about the external ear right here? You need that to hear. Again, if you fill this up with glue or something, could you hear? Or a wad of cotton or something? Or an earplug? No, you couldn't hear anything. So for the sense of hearing, you need the external ear, the middle ear, and the inner ear in order to hear stuff. Right? What about the sense of static equilibrium? What part of the ear do you need for static equilibrium? Do you need external? You don't. That's right. You could wear an earplug and you would know exactly where your head position is, no problem. What about the middle ear? The middle ear for static equilibrium? You know what? You don't. It's only for hearing. Because static equilibrium has nothing to do with the vibration of those auditory ossicles. All right, but what about the inner ear? You need that for static equilibrium. Yeah, what part in particular? The vestibule. Okay, and what about kinetic equilibrium? You need any part of the inner ear? Yeah, you need the semicircular canals, the three semicircular canals. Do you need a middle ear for kinetic equilibrium? As a matter of fact, you don't. And of course, you don't need an outer ear either. So only for the sense of hearing do you need an outer ear and a middle. All right, but for static equilibrium, kinetic equilibrium, and hearing, you need all three parts of the inner ear. Right? Okay. So that's one interesting way to think of that. Okay, for the inner ear, you need for hearing, for static equilibrium, and kinetic equilibrium. So you need the inner ear for all senses of the ear. But for the middle ear and outer ear, that's only for hearing. You don't need that for any of the equilibrium senses. Okay? All right, so let me write a little table on the board right here. Well, what are the three senses in the ear? We've got... awfully quiet. Hearing. Okay? You got hearing, and you've got static, and I'm just going to abbreviate equilibrium as EQ. And then you've got what? Kinetic EQ. Okay, so right here, I'm going to go to a darker marker, I think. Oh, nice. Bony labyrinth responsible for hearing. That's that little bony thing inside the, this is going to be the inner ear for hearing. The bony thing that's necessary for you to hear in the inner ear. That is the cochlea. All right, so bony labyrinth, that's cochlea. What about for static equilibrium? That's the vestibule. And the bony labyrinth for kinetic equilibrium, the semicircular canals. Okay, so that's a bony labyrinth. What about the organ? Number two, the organ for hearing. What's the name of the organ that allows you to hear? Organ of Corti. That's easy. What about the organ for static equilibrium? Yeah, the macula. All right, and you have two of them. So I say maculae right here. You've got the utricle and saccule. Right, these are both maculae. I forgot the word. Cochlea, thank you. Cochlea. And in the maculae, what's the strange thing about the maculae that probably you'd never realized before? You have, what do you have inside the middle ear? Okay, you got those hair cells, that's something, yeah, that's new probably. But you also have those little crystals inside your ear, right, that gravity pulls on to deform the hair cells. So don't forget about those little crystals inside the maculae. And what's the organ in the semicircular canals? Yeah, the crista ampullaris. The crista ampullaris. And so there's some similarity between these different organs, like there's that gelatinous mass in the macula, there's that gelatin in the crista ampullaris, right? And then the last thing that we should put on the board is the receptor cell. So what's the receptor cell that gives you the sense of hearing called? Hair cell. Are you sure about that? That's so weird. But you're right. It's called a hair cell. What about the receptor cell for static equilibrium? Oh, you got to be kidding me now. It's called a hair cell? As a matter of fact, you're right. It's called a hair cell. So it's very similar to these hair cells in the organ of Corti. What about for kinetic equilibrium? What's the receptor cell? It's a hair cell once again. Okay, so that's actually pretty strange that these three very different kinds of senses that you have in your body are produced by basically the same kind of receptor cell. It's just that when electrical information comes from these three different receptors, it goes to three different locations in the brain. And so it's the location in the brain that gives you the sense of that particular modality, whether it's hearing or linear acceleration or angular acceleration, okay, which are really different kinds of senses. Unless you can hear motion. Can anybody hear motion? No? Okay. You can hear something moving sometimes. True. Okay. Okay, so I think that's it for special senses, hearing, the three kinds of equilibrium. These are what the hairs really look like inside the ear. Okay, but now we got to go over the study guide, because that's going to be important for the test coming up on when? Tuesday. All right, so I'm going to turn the projector off. All right, so how many questions we got? Oh, 14 questions. Okay, two exam figures. What are considered general or somatic senses, and which are considered special? Let's talk about some general senses. First, what is a general sense in a general way? And then we'll talk about some specific examples. I know that sounds weird. Where does general senses come from? All over your body, different places in your body, right? So you can feel pain, temperature, anywhere on the surface of your body. Right, so pain is a general sense, temperature is a general sense, vibration, and touch is a general sense. What else is there? There's one that seems like it should be a special sense, but it's not. It's called proprioception. So proprioception is a general sense. And it's a general sense because you have proprioceptors all over your body, in every single muscle, every single tendon, and joint. So it's a sense of, like body position, but that's different than equilibrium. I want you to be aware that it's different than body position. It's basically just a measure of tension that you have in muscles that gives you a sense of body position, like where your hand is, where your arms are at, that kind of thing. All right, so proprioception sounds like it's a special sense, but it's not. It's general because they're all over the place. So what's the distinction between general and special senses? General senses, all over your body. Special senses, one or two organs, actually very nicely complicated organs, in one or two places in your body. And so let's list. Let's list the special senses. What's one special sense? Olfaction, smell. What else? Sight, vision. That's two. Hearing, three. Equilibrium. How many kinds are there? There's two, so that's five, four, five. And then what else? And taste. Yeah, gustatory sense. So those are all special senses, because you have special sense organs. All right, so number two, be able to classify the following as either general or special. Pain, general. Temperature, touch, general. Vision, special. Pressure, general. Oh, that's right, I almost said special, but it's not. It's general. Proprioception, general. Yeah, hearing, special. Taste, special. Olfaction, special. Static equilibrium is special. Kinetic equilibrium. Yeah. What is the bony labyrinth necessary for kinetic equilibrium? That's not on you. I'm giving you a curveball here. The semicircular canal. That's right, semicircular canal. All right, what is olfaction and what does it sense? Olfaction is a sense of smell. What does it sense? Molecules that we call odorant molecules. They sense, or you could say odors. Olfaction senses odors. Okay, so odor is not supposed to have a good or bad connotation. It's just a molecule that you can smell with your nose. All right, what cranial nerve transmits olfactory sensory signals? And that's cranial nerve number one. What do they call that? The olfactory nerve. Yeah, the olfactory nerve. That's cranial nerve number one, because that's the most anterior one coming from your brain. And to what lobe of the cerebrum do they go? Olfaction. Yeah, that goes to the temporal lobe. Goes to the temporal lobe. All right, what are the four primary taste sensations? Yeah, you like bitter, sweet, sour, and salt. And actually, there's a fifth one. Did I mention the fifth one? Umami, which is due to amino acids. It's a sense of deliciousness. All right, and glutamate stimulates those taste receptors. Where are they arranged on the tongue? Where's sweet at? On the tip, bitter and sour are in the posterior tongue, and salty is kind of along the sides. I don't know if you have a picture in your book of that or not, so I don't know how important that is, but just remember, sweet on the tip of your tongue. What are accessory structures associated with vision? Eyebrows, eyelids, eyelashes, what's a tear gland called? Lacrimal gland. Also, there are some muscles that move your eyeball around. What are those called? Makes you look right, look left. The extrinsic eye muscles. Extrinsic eye muscles. I think we talked about extrinsic eye muscles. Yeah. Okay. Those are accessory structures. Okay. What are the layers of the eye? Let's start with the outermost layer, the most superficial layer. That's the? That is? The one that's white. That's the sclera. Yeah, the sclera. That's the really tough layer. It protects the eyeball. And then the next deepest one, which is the middle layer, contains blood vessels. That's the choroid. And then the deepest layer of the eye is the retina. What does the retina contain? Yeah, photoreceptor cells. And you're right, the rods and cones. Those are photoreceptor cells. All right, what layer contains blood vessels? The choroid. What layer contains photoreceptor cells? The retina. And what are the two kinds of photoreceptor cells? Rods and cones. Where are they located in the retina? Where are cones located? They're right in the middle of your vision, your central vision, right? Or what we call the posterior pole of the eye. That gives you color vision and fine detail. That's where your best vision is, right smack in the middle. Okay? And if you were to go right or left from the middle, that's what we call the periphery of your vision, or up or down from the very middle. That's what we call peripheral vision. That's where we find rod cells.
Where?
In your peripheral vision. Periphery. That's around your central vision. And that's really not important for a lot of detail. It doesn't give you a lot of detail. And there's something else that the rod cells cannot do. They can't give you color vision. That's right. They only sense black and white. So they're good for black, white, gray, and low resolution detail. They can only see big things, not little fine details. But they're good for something. What are they good for? Because why do we have them if they're not good for anything? They work in dim light. They work in dim light. So if we were to turn the lights off, eventually we'd be able to see in here because our rod cells would take over and they would allow us to see. And as a matter of fact, you could go out tonight and sort of prove that feature to yourself. If you look up at the sky and there's stars up there, they're not really bright, but that's good. If you look with your central vision, look at a star that's not too bright, look with your central vision, those are the cone cells. What kind of light do cone cells need? Really bright light. So if you look at a star with your central vision, you might not be able to see it because the star isn't bright enough. But if you look, so if the star's in the same place, but now look a little bit to the left, now all of a sudden with your peripheral vision, you can see the star because you'll see it with the rod cells, which are very sensitive to light. So you can see it. And then, so if you're looking to the side and then you look at it again and it disappears, which is kind of funny. And then look to the side again and it will pop into your consciousness. Okay. Okay. So where are the photocells? The cones are in your central vision. Now there's a place on your retina where you can't see anything. What's that called? The blind spot. And I didn't show anybody last time after class your blind spot. So if you want to see your blind spot after class, I can put a diagram on the board so you can, I'll put my finger there and you'll see my finger just disappear because you can't see it. It's in your blind spot. Remind me to do that. Okay, what are the two humors of the eye? Where are they located? Humors means fluid. What are the two kinds of fluid in your eye? There is, yeah, vitreous and aqueous, or you could say aqueous and vitreous. I would say aqueous and vitreous. Aqueous is like water that's in the anterior cavity of the eye. The anterior cavity is anterior to the lens. And the vitreous humor is like jello or jelly. It doesn't flow very easily. That's in the posterior cavity of the eye. That's right up against the retina. It holds the retina in position. So those are the two humors and where they're located. And we talked about that aqueous humor because if you damage your anterior eye, what can happen to that aqueous humor? It just runs right down your face. And then the cornea can touch the iris and the iris can touch the lens and then they get stuck together forever. Okay. What two structures of the eye work together to focus light on the retina? Those I had marked with an asterisk in your notes. So there are two structures that focus light on the retina, and you need to focus light in order to see something, what? Sharply, otherwise it's going to be blurry. So the two things that are curved, they got to have curvature to them. The first one is your cornea. Yeah, the cornea is right on the outside of the eye, and then the deeper structure that's curved is the lens, of course. So both the cornea and the lens allow you to focus sharply on something. And probably the more important of the two is the cornea. It has more curvature to it and provides for more focusing power. Okay, but what does the lens do for you? If it's not so important as the cornea for focusing, what is the purpose of the lens? Yeah, when you change your distance of focus from your eye, the lens changes shape so that you can see things close up. But if you see things close up, you can't see things far away. So if you want to see things far away, the lens has to change shape so you can see things far away. But then what happens to things up close? They get blurry. You can't focus on both at the same time, one or the other. All right, so what muscle, what ligament, and optical component of the eye function in accommodation? So do you know what accommodation is? Accommodation is your ability to see things up close and then far away, but you can't do both at the same time. That's what we call accommodation. All right, so that's like for reading or for looking at something in the distance. So what things have to change in your eye and what produces that change? Or what is the thing that has to change shape in order for you to change your length of focus? It is the lens, right? It changes shape. It can go from something thick or something really thin, thick with a lot of curvature or thin with hardly any curvature. So there's a muscle that can pull on it. What's the name of the muscle? The ciliary body. Some books call it a ciliary muscle. I think your book calls it the ciliary body. And how does the ciliary body attach to the lens? There's a ligament called the suspensory ligament. So that ciliary body changes the shape of the lens so that you can accommodate. What are the three general divisions of the ear? Yeah, from outside to inside, it's outer, middle, and inner. And you should know what's in those three different spaces. Okay. What separates, let's see if you have a picture in your mind, what separates the outer ear from the middle ear is a membrane. That's called the tympanic membrane. And there's a membrane, another membrane that separates the middle ear from the inner ear. There are actually two of them. They're called windows. What are the two windows? The oval window and the round window. Which one has the stapes connected to it? It's the oval window. That's how sound enters the inner ear. How does sound leave the inner ear so that it doesn't blow up? Bless you. It leaves through the round window, right? The round window can vibrate back and forth too, relieving the pressure that gets in there from the oval window. All right, what three general divisions of the ear? Which special senses are involved with each? All right, so outer ear, what's a special sense? Hearing. The middle ear, what special senses?
Hearing
again, only. And the middle ear? Hearing and static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium, all three. Hearing and the two kinds of equilibrium are for the inner ear. Okay, number 11. What three senses are associated with the inner ear? Well, we just sort of did that already. It's what? Hearing, static equilibrium, kinetic equilibrium. And what sense is associated with the external and middle ear?
Hearing.
Well, I'm really beating that question up a lot. Maybe it's on the test or something. I don't know. Okay. All right, number 12. What are auditory ossicles? What are auditory ossicles? Whenever you hear that term, ossicle or osteo, you should think of bone, right? So, and these are auditory, these are bones that have to do with hearing. Am I kidding you again? No, you have those bones. Where are the bones, where are those auditory ossicles located? In the middle ear in particular, middle ear. All right, between what membranes are the auditory ossicles? Between the tympanic membrane and the oval window. And that defines the middle ear. All right, that's where those auditory ossicles are. What are their names? Maybe starting with the tympanic membrane. It's the incus, malleus, and stapes. Incus, malleus, and stapes. Okay, I think we already talked about where is the tympanic membrane, the oval window and round window located. But tympanic membrane is right between the outer ear and the middle ear. That's what the malleus attaches to. And the oval window is right between the middle ear and the inner ear. That's what the stapes attaches to. And the round window, sort of like the oval window, is right between the inner ear and the middle ear, but there's nothing attached to it. It just vibrates back and forth. All right, here's a good question. You should tell me this one. What is the name of the organ responsible for hearing? Organ of Corti. You got it. And in what bony labyrinth is it located in? In the cochlea. It's located in the cochlea. Name the cell primarily responsible for transducing sound into nerve signals. It's a hair cell. Okay. Number 13. What is the name of the organ responsible for static equilibrium? Yeah, one of them is a macula. And you have two of them, so plural would be maculae. What is the bony labyrinth that it is located in? It's in the vestibule. That's the middle part of that bony labyrinth. Name the cell primarily responsible for transducing body position into nerve signals. It's a hair cell. Yeah. All right, then our last question. What's the name of the organ responsible for kinetic equilibrium? The crista ampullaris, yeah. What's the bony labyrinth it is located in? Semicircular canal. What's another way of saying kinetic equilibrium? How would you describe that to somebody? What's that the sense of? Spinning, right, rotational acceleration, spinning. Name the cell primarily responsible for transducing kinetic motion, like spinning, into nerve signals. The hair cells again. All right, so that's it for senses. So we're doing good for the test. And you can practice those exam figures. All right, so now we're going to move on to blood. And I didn't put any lecture notes in Blackboard for blood, so I printed them out and made some copies. And I might have enough copies for everybody. I'm not sure. Now, some of these have the figures on them, and some don't. So over the weekend, I'll put some of these study guides on the internet that have the figures. There's only one figure for blood. There's only one figure for blood, so that's not so critical. Okay. You got them. Yeah, that's it right there. Probably doesn't make much sense right at the moment, but it will. Functions of blood. But if you want to get a copy of the figure today before you leave, just come up to the office with me and I'll make a photocopy for you, okay? Okay, so blood. Before we go to blood, does anybody have any questions over what might be on the test or special senses, general senses? And also, don't forget, there's that little video that you can watch on the website on the difference between general and special senses if you're confused on that that point. Okay. Well, all right, so what is blood? What kind of tissue is blood? Ooh, this is going way back to the beginning of the semester. What kind of tissue is blood? It's connective tissue. It's a strange kind of connective tissue. Why? Because it's fluid, right? It flows. It's a connective tissue because it connects different parts of your body together because it flows from one point to another, right? So that's interesting. Now, I think my slides are maybe a little bit different than yours because... First, what do I have? I have functions of blood. Let's go over the functions of blood. Okay, so the first one, I think, is probably kind of obvious to you folks, but some of the others really aren't too obvious. Blood connects your body together, so it transports oxygen that we breathe into our body. What do you need oxygen for? What do you need oxygen for? To make what? To make ATP. That's right. So you got to have oxygen going to all your tissues. So blood transports oxygen. There's special cells in your blood that specifically transport oxygen. It transmits or transports nutrients. What's a good kind of nutrient to think about that's transported in your blood? And some people have big problems with transporting this nutrient because maybe it goes too high. The level goes too high in the blood. And then it goes too low. And for instance, that would be glucose. What's the disease process involved with not being able to regulate blood glucose concentration? That would be diabetes mellitus, right? There are a number of enzymes in the blood, which we're going to talk about. Hormones are signaling molecules that change how your body, it's a way to control different parts of your body through hormones. So it's a signaling molecule. Blood also transports waste products, like carbon dioxide. So when your body makes ATP, when it uses oxygen, it produces CO2, that's a waste product. And other kind of waste products are transported by the blood from your tissues, maybe to your kidneys or to your liver for detoxification. Another important function is your body likes to operate at a single temperature, 98.6. But when you start to exercise a muscle, its temperature goes way up. And so the way that that muscle cools down is blood goes to the muscle, absorbs the heat, and then blood takes that heat to another part of your body and gets rid of it, like to your skin or to your lungs or something. So blood is important for heat transfer, transport of heat in your body. So that means to maintain body temperature. Blood is important for that. Blood is important to maintain electrolyte concentration in your body. In order for nerves to work correctly, they got to have the right amount of sodium and potassium in it, right? So blood helps regulate electrolytes and fluids, which is water, as well as the pH of your body. So blood regulates pH. And sixth thing is that blood helps fight infections or foreign substances. It could fight parasites, it can fight bacterial infections, viral infections, fungal infections, all kinds of different kinds of infections. We'll see what kinds of cells are important for that. And blood also can help fight tumors, right? Probably all of us in here have had a tumor that we never even knew about because certain components of our blood destroyed the tumor before it got to be a problem. But in some people, their blood cells aren't smart enough to figure out how to kill a particular tumor, and then it might turn into cancer or turn into a real problem for them. But that probably develops in everybody, but our blood does a really good job mostly in protecting us from tumors. And then another important part, the last one, another important function of blood, if you were to cut yourself, or in particular cut a blood vessel, since it's a fluid, it will do what? It will just flow right out of your body, and then you'll be deficient all those other important functions, so you don't want to lose blood. And so another important function of blood is that it will stop blood loss when you have damage to a blood vessel. So it will form a clot. So clotting function is another important function of blood to maintain the fluid that you do have. All right. So when we look at blood, there are different ways to think of it. So if you ever, anybody ever get their blood analyzed in a hospital or anything, what do they got to do? They got to take some blood out of you, right? So they stick a needle in and they aspirate some blood out. So that fluid that they take out of your body is what we call whole blood, right? It's a complete product. It has everything in there. And whole blood can be broken down into two kinds of categories. It can be broken down into plasma, that's the fluid part of blood, and then the second part is what we call formed elements. Formed elements are the cells that make up blood. And this might sort of be a review to you, because we talked about this, I think, when we were looking at tissues. So these are the two parts of blood, the fluid part and the cellular part. The fluid is called plasma. It's pale yellow looking when you look at it, because there's a lot of stuff dissolved in that fluid. And the cellular part are what we call formed elements. Okay. So, if we take whole blood out of somebody, what the heck does it look like? It looks, I guess, probably something like this right here. Okay, here's the fluid part. What's this part called? Plasma. And then here is a cell. That's one of the formed elements. Here's another kind of cell. That's a formed element, and then here's some little tiny cells over here. Those are formed elements as well. So you got the fluid part or plasma and the formed elements. All right, let's talk about the plasma first, which is the fluid part. What's in plasma? Most of it is just pure water. 92% is pure water. So anything that will dissolve in water can dissolve in plasma, including some proteins. Proteins will dissolve in plasma, and these are the things that actually give plasma its particular color. There's a protein called albumin that's important for water balance, that maintains the osmotic pressure of blood, right? So that makes it isotonic with your cells. There are globulins that fight infections, so these are molecules that fight infections. And then there are clotting factors. These are proteins. And what does a clotting factor help do? Yeah, it stops blood loss when you damage a blood vessel, right? So that's an important kind of protein to have. And then there are ions like sodium ions, potassium ions, calcium ions. You have nutrients. What's a good kind of nutrient to think about in blood? for instance, we just mentioned that. Glucose, right? Glucose. Then there are gases. What kind of gases? What gases do you inhale to get in your body? Oxygen. What gas is a waste product that you breathe out? CO2. All right. And then there are molecules which are waste products, like urea. Urea is a waste product from a breakdown of proteins, and it's pretty toxic. And so your body has to get rid of that, and it's the job of your kidneys to get rid of urea for you. All right, but it's carried by the blood, from your tissues to the blood, and then from the blood to kidneys, and then your kidneys put it in urine, right? And then you void that urine, and that urea leaves your body. All right, here's a term that you should be aware of. Here's plasma. That's what we're talking about, right? We were just talking about everything that's in plasma. If we take plasma and remove only the clotting factors from it, which is this protein component, we're left with something. And what we're left with is what we call serum. All right, so serum is plasma with everything in it except clotting factors. So serum cannot clot, but it contains all the other good things that the plasma should contain, like glucose and ions and maybe oxygen and all these other kinds of proteins as well. Okay, so serum contains things that can fight infections. Right, so sometimes a serum is given to somebody to help fight an infection, but it's not going to produce any kind of clotting abnormality in that person because it's what? It doesn't have clotting factors in it. But it's something that can bolster somebody's immune system, maybe to fight a venom or something that unfortunately got inside somebody. How do you get envenomated by something? You get bitten by a snake or a spider, right, or a bee or something like that, okay? And you can be given proteins, these globulins that fight those compounds, those venoms, to prevent tissue damage. All right, so that's plasma. Formed elements, we've got a couple of different kinds of formed elements in blood. Most of them, 95% of them, are red blood cells. And red blood cells just look like this. They kind of are very circular in nature, right, with a dimple on the inside. And do you see any organelles? Do you see any organelles inside the cell? As a matter of fact, you don't. It doesn't have any organelles. So it's a really strange kind of cell. It doesn't have a nucleus, doesn't have organelles, but it has some enzymes in there, and it has ATP in there and some other high-energy compounds. But it mostly contains a chemical compound that will absorb oxygen and transport oxygen everywhere in your body. Right? So oxygen is transported by red blood cells because it has that chemical that can absorb oxygen, and that's called hemoglobin. So the job of this red blood cell is to load up with as much hemoglobin as possible so it can carry as much oxygen as possible, and that's what keeps us alive. It doesn't have room for organelles. But if it doesn't have a nucleus, doesn't have mitochondria, how long do you think these guys live for? Long time or a relatively short time? A short time, right? Unfortunately, they don't live very long. And, okay, and then they have to be replaced. All right, when we get to red blood cells, maybe I'll talk a little bit more about that. Now, red blood cells can change shape a little bit because the membrane is very fluid. It can squish in really, really small blood vessels to get through very small blood vessels in your body. All right, another name for a red blood cell is called an erythrocyte. So erythrocyte and red blood cell, or RBC, are exactly the same thing. What does cyte mean? That means cell. Guess what erythro means? It means red. That's right. So it just means red cell. The next most prevalent kind of cell is a white blood cell. Sometimes we call them, what, WBCs, white blood cells. And these are nucleated. They do have a nucleus in them. So, for instance, here's another picture of, this would be whole blood right here. We can see some plasma. What do these look like? Yeah, what's another name? Erythrocyte. And then these guys here, you can see the nucleus. These are white blood cells, because you can see a nucleus in them. And white blood cells, another name for a white blood cell is leukocyte. All right, so what's another name for cyte? cell. Leuco, guess what leuco means? It's white in Latin, I believe, right? And some animals have big white patches on them, and they're always given that name leuco something. And what's the symbol of the United States? The animal symbol of the United States. It's a bird. It's a bald eagle, because it has a lot of white feathers on its head, so it kind of looks bald, I suppose. And so its scientific name is leucocephalus, which means, leuco means white, cephalus means toward the head, white head, big white-headed bird. So leuco, don't forget, leuco means white. And the job of white blood cells is to fight infection. It's important for immune response. All right, so they help fight colds, bacterial infections, okay, that you might get. And then the third kind of cell is what we call a platelet. And we can see platelets on this slide right here. All right, we see these red blood cells, white blood cells. Here are platelets. How big are these platelets compared to leukocytes and erythrocytes? They're really small. They're really cell fragments. They're pieces of a cell that have broken off, right? But they still have a cell membrane. They're really tiny, but that's why we call them a formed element. All of these things are formed elements. So you could think of a platelet as like being a tiny, tiny cell, but they're really hardly a cell. But they're just a little tiny sac with cytoplasm inside of them. Another name for a platelet is a thrombocyte. Okay, don't forget, cyte means cell. Thrombo, what does thrombo mean? It means clot. So platelets are real important for clotting function, for preventing blood loss when you damage a blood vessel. That's the job of a platelet or a thrombocyte. It plugs up a blood vessel when it starts to bleed. Okay. And I think maybe we're going to start here next time. So this right here is whole blood. There's a lot of times when we want to analyze the different components of whole blood. And we do that by measuring hematocrit. So maybe over the weekend, oh, you got to study for the test over the weekend. But over the weekend, look up hematocrit anyway. So because a week from today, all right, we're going to do what? Start here. Okay. Ah, thank you. All right, so here's an extra study guide with a figure on it if you want one for blood. And if you want to see your blind spot, I'll help you see your blind spot.